WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're middle class and you think the wealthy have been prospering at your expense, you're right, according to Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele. They just completed an investigative series for the Philadelphia Inquirer on the dismantling of the American middle class. They found that we are in the midst of the largest transfer of wealth in the nation's history. Want a shocking example? In the 1980s, the average increase in salary of people earning more than $1 million was 2,184%. Average increase for people earning $20,000 to $50,000, 44%. So the rich are getting richer, and the middle class and the poor are the losers. Why? Because in the past 20 years, Washington rigged the game to favor the privileged, the powerful, and the influential at the expense of everyone else. How? Through the tax code, the bankruptcy code, and deregulation. The tax code was rewritten in 1986, and it ended up saving wealthy individuals lots of money. Also in the 1980s, corporations exploited an old deduction, which allows businesses to not pay interest on debt. This helped finance the takeovers that reshaped the business world in the 80s.
There is absolutely no question that throughout the 80s, corporate debt was simply running out of control. And there were any number of hearings in Congress in which they examined the issue, but the special interests made sure that that deduction was kept. The deduction was part of the tax code from day one, but it had not become an issue until the 1980s when the debt spiraled out of control. And as Jim indicated, the debt wasn't used to create jobs. It was really used to rearrange assets or reshuffle corporations or merge or restructure, but not to build new industries or not to invest in research and development or new products or create new jobs. And so without a doubt, the single most destructive element was the just continued unlimited deduction for corporate debt.
So in other words, you didn't have to pay tax on corporate
right.
debt. And the 80s became the decade of corporate takeovers where,
That's
you know,
right.
financed
Absolutely.
By junk bonds and everything. One company would buy another company, dismantle that company, sell it off. And
right.
So can you explain how the pieces of that puzzle fit together in hurting the middle class? You know, it seems like a big leap to, you know, the junk bonds and the corporate takeovers to, like, our savings accounts.
You have to look at, let's just look at one company that we looked at,
yeah.
which is an example of just that process. And we looked at dozens and dozens. But one was a company called Interco, based in St. Louis, employed 50,000 people, one of the largest manufacturing companies in America. Furniture, Florsheim shoes, London Fog raincoats, a whole range of products came out of that company. It was the subject of a raid in the late 1980s, and to repulse that raid, it loaded up with a lot of debt, which then led to a payout to shareholders. Not that debt did not create more jobs or plants or whatever. Because of that debt, it was unable to generate sufficient income to pay the interest on that debt, which then led to the selling of any number of divisions, which they in turn then loaded up with debt, the closing of various plants. We talked to families in a number of places that were hurt by that. One was a little town out in Missouri called Herman, Missouri, a German town founded, strangely enough, by Philadelphians in the 19th century. The shoe plant had been there since, I believe, the middle of the 19th century in one form or another. I'm sorry, I think the early part of the 20th century, but whenever it was. It had been a fixture in the town, hardworking people, very profitable enterprise, but because the company needed to raise cash, they had to close it. And the result was people who lived there, mostly middle-class employees who'd lived there for a long time, lost their jobs. And we saw that story repeated over and over again across America. To take care of the debt, you sell the asset, you close the plant, you scale back benefits, a direct cause and effect in terms of middle-class lifestyles.
If you're just joining us, my guests are investigative reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele. They're both with the Philadelphia Inquirer, and their new series of articles, which has just been published, is called America, What Went Wrong? And it's about the dismantling of the American middle class. An interesting statistic, you know, in talking about how corporate debt was used in the 1980s, you say if your income was less than $30,000 in the 1980s, Every penny that you paid in federal income tax the entire decade went just to offset the taxes lost from the deduction for interest on corporate debt. It's pretty amazing.
No, that's correct. And what people tend to forget is that when you give a tax break on one part of the system, someone else has to pick it up, or else it goes into the federal deficit, which is obviously growing and growing, and you pay the interest on that. But that corporate interest deduction, if you look at it through the 80s, that write-off was worth more to corporations than they actually paid in income taxes. In other words, they avoided more in taxes than they actually paid as a result of this single deduction.
And that was a complete turnaround from, let's say, the 1950s, even really the 1960s, and then the 70s, if I'm not mistaken. And that's what's significant about it. It's not something that's always been that completely flip-flopped in the 1980s.
This is an important point because we're talking about laws and regulations, and what has happened in the 80s really wasn't new. I mean, it's happened before in this country. You saw it back at the turn of the century, and you saw it again in the 1920s. You saw it at the turn of the century with the creation of the fortunes at that time and the corporate restructurings that went on then and then again in the 20s. But what is different this time is that there's no response from Congress. There's no response from Washington. You go back at the turn of the century, you see the child labor laws, you see the antitrust laws, you see an incredible outpouring of legislation to try to correct the imbalance that has built up. And it culminates really with the passage of the federal income tax, the progressive income tax. You go into the 1920s, there's again a lot of corporate restructuring. The tax code is revised to favor those at the top, and you have the same situation emerge. Then you go into the 30s, and Congress responds again with a whole laundry list of social reforms and programs culminating with Social Security. Now you're into the 1980s and the 1990s, and there is dead silence out of Congress. The responses that came earlier throughout this century are not there.
If you're just joining us, my guests are James Bartlett and Donald Steele, and they're investigative reporters who've worked as a team for many years. They've just concluded a new series of articles for the Philadelphia Inquirer called America, What Went Wrong? And it's about the dismantling of the American middle class. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Investigative reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele are my guests. Their new series for the Philadelphia Inquirer is called America, What Went Wrong? And we've been talking about how the tax codes changed and how that helped the wealthy, how it helped corporations, how it hurt the middle class and the working class. Now, the bankruptcy code was also rewritten in a way that you say also helped to restructure the corporate world in a way that hurt working people. What went wrong?
Well, I think it's like so many things. Certain intentions were right. You wanted to reform the bankruptcy laws. You wanted to create your own jurisdiction to handle this. And even one of the original ideas supposedly was to protect jobs. You don't put a company out of business. You let it stay in business so the jobs are kept and so forth. But the problem is because bankruptcy reorganization has become so appealing, companies at the drop of the hat anymore, once they've loaded up with debt and so forth, very often go into bankruptcy and then go through a dismantling process. They're not usually completely shut down, but the process of reorganizing in bankruptcy has become a whole new industry now.
You say that in the 1980s there was the largest increase in corporate bankruptcies since the Depression.
You can look at the financial statements of just literally hundreds of companies, and you look down the list of numbers, what you see is the company is actually making a profit until they come to the payment of interest on their debt, and the entire profit disappears, and they're actually in the hole because they are not generating enough money to pay the interest on their debt. These are companies that were profitable prior to taking on the debt, would have been profitable, would have stayed in business, would have paid taxes. And this is why the corporate tax collections have also fallen, because that interest basically wipes out all their tax bills.
One of the articles that you wrote in this series, I think, is very disturbing, and it's about how fragile our pension funds are. I don't know. I think when you have a pension, you think, well, it's going to be there when you retire. But you're cautioning us that some pension funds, in fact, won't be there when we retire.
This, as Jim indicated, this is another case of good intentions gone awry. When Congress created the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, the idea was to guarantee people's pensions. And this came after Studebaker Corporation folded, and you had thousands of people who had worked there all their lives and wound up with no pension. And so what Congress did was, well, we'll create this guarantee fund, very much like the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation for banks. Companies will pay a dollar a worker, and that'll guarantee everybody's pension. And on the surface, it seemed like a good idea. But what has happened is that, once again, it's been twisted. So the companies that are mismanaged simply go into bankruptcy or abandon their pension plans, whereas the well-managed companies that remain must pick up the slack for those failed businesses. And as those failed businesses increase, the well-run companies are called upon more and more to create more and more contribute more and more money to this purpose. So they are naturally looking at this and say, we don't need this. They're changing their pension plans and bailing out of the system. So as a result, the percentage of the workforce with a guaranteed pension has been declining steadily.
Now, you also found that debt-financed corporate takeovers ended up looting a lot of pension plans.
Absolutely, because this became a way to use that cash for additional raids on other companies. And again, the federal government basically passed on that process of the removal because that was a rule that they looked the other way on in the 1980s, because all the actuarial studies said that you could do this and you could achieve that result. But one of the things that nobody could ever answer is that the basis of it was supposedly these funds were overfunded. One of the reasons they were overfunded was because of some economic activity in the 80s where stock prices went up, where asset values went up. Now, in retrospect, probably on an inflated basis, a lot of those assets were taken out at the time. And now, when nothing is going to perform in exactly the way it had been in the 80s, the removal of those funds from those plans is not going to look so nice.
This was another aspect of it. It was kind of a heads-I-win-tails-you-lose situation in which the government says you can take the money out of the pension fund, and if the pension fund collapses, the government will pay the pensions. It didn't say, on the other hand, that the company would be responsible for those pensions if it took the money out. So the company kind of had it both ways. It could take the money out, and if the company collapsed, just walk away from it all.
Sounds a lot like the savings and loan situation.
It is a carbon copy of the savings and loan. And last Friday, I believe, there was testimony in Congress from the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation that the underfunded pensions went up another $10 billion in the last year. They now stand at $40 billion, and that's growing.
So in various ways, we, the individual citizens of America, are paying for the savings and loan crisis. We're paying for the looting of pension funds.
You're paying for everything.
So the fate of the middle class now. We're facing more unemployment, harder to get health insurance, more expensive health insurance, loss of various benefits from guaranteed pensions to dental plans and health insurance plans. What else? What are some of the other traumas that the middle class is facing now?
I'd like to talk about one, which isn't, you can't put an economic dollar on it, but it has to do with something we came across time and time again, company after company, across industries, from manufacturing to retail to you name it, and it's loyalty. I mean, so many people worked for companies. They felt loyal to these companies. They spent their entire working life in these companies. Maybe they were 49, 50, 55, 56, and it had been a good company to work for, and they loved their jobs. They were hardworking, and then their life was completely turned upside down. I mean, it's kind of a violation in a way of the American work ethic for a lot of those people. I mean, it's a terrible loss, I think, of faith in the entire system that anyone who's gone through that process has suffered. You can't put a dollar sign on it, but that was a theme that we kept running. We ran into that almost from day one, and we kept running into it time and time again. The quotes sounded the same. You talk to a timber man in the Sierra, in the Sierras of California, and his quotes would sound very similar to a glass worker in West Virginia or to a shoemaker in Missouri or somebody else down in Texas.
I think that was one of the most startling revelations out of this whole project, because he would come back from one part of the country and I would come back with another, and our quotes would almost be identical. And they were coming from people who obviously totally different work in totally different working conditions, totally different industries, but their attitudes toward the companies they worked for were identical.
So this kind of thing could really undermine, in the future, a sense of commitment to the place that you work.
I don't think there's any question about undermining loyalty to a company. There's absolutely no question about it. You heard that over and over and over again from people who would say, I will never do that again.
And I'll never trust the people I work for again.
That's exactly right.
And it has a downward movement, obviously within their families and within their communities. When people see an institution that has been such a vital part, completely in effect, turn on the people for whatever reason, it sort of poisons the well.
So just to highlight some of the areas that you've covered here, deregulation, including deregulation of the savings and loan crisis, changing tax code, an ability for corporations to pay less on their taxes. All of this basically making life easier for wealthy individuals and wealthy corporations and making life harder for the working and middle class. What do you point to? Was it the presidents, the Congress?
People on both sides of the aisle, which is the phrase they use in Washington, really can share, take a lot of credit for what has happened here, or share some of the blame, depending on how you look at it. And I think that's a point that Don and I would really like to emphasize, that we are the most non-political people you will ever find.
You two?
The two of us. It's not a matter of Republicans or Democrats or anything like that. You can see that while in the 80s you had a Republican in the White House, in fact, many of these measures were started prior to that. The whole deregulation concept predated Reagan's arrival in the White House, though he obviously embraced this tremendously. Trucking and airline deregulation were under Jimmy Carter, and the people that pushed that in the Senate were basically Democratic. The principal instrument that led to a lot of the savings and loan debacle was the Rhode Island Democratic congressman, and who raised the depository insurance limit up to $100,000. I mean, that insured a lot of that chaos. So there's a lot of blame really on both parties. So it's not a simple thing like that. And I think in part that may be what is complicating the process of trying to come to grips with this, because both have had a share in what's happened.
One of the places where you put the blame is at the foot of the lobbyists and the Congress who is influenced by the lobbyists. You point out Michael Milken basically had his own lobby to make sure that corporate debt remained tax exempt.
Absolutely, because the engine that drove the whole junk bond movement was corporate debt. That was the deduction for interest paid on corporate debt. And what you see in Washington over and over again is that lobbies arise to deal with specific situations, and then they vanish when they feel that the house is secure.
I think the most frightening words in your whole series were these: the worst is yet to come.
I think those words go to the heart of what we've been saying, is that you see nothing happening in Washington. You see no recognition that there is something really seriously wrong that requires not just a little tinkering or a little fine-tuning, but some massive changes in the way things are being done.
I mean, for example, nobody would like to see everybody get a better tax break than we would, but the response now is we've got to cut the taxes of the middle class. That's a great issue just to toss out to make people pay attention and so forth. But it's a lot broader than just that. I mean, this is like now it's swung back, we'll pander to the middle class here. By the tax policymakers in Washington, they're all churning out their programs for middle class tax relief, when in fact many of the same people are the ones that got the country into this particular situation. It's a much broader range of tax issues than just something like that. But that sounds real good as a nice little one-liner.
It's an extraordinarily simplistic response to what is really a very complicated situation. You had, when you go back to the 86 Tax Act, both Republicans and Democrats sold that Tax Reform Act as helping the middle class. It did not. It was probably the single most destructive tax act since the 1924 Act as far as middle class America was concerned.
The elections are coming up. Is election time a depressing time for you because all these major issues are never discussed or certainly not discussed in their full, complicated, difficult...
They're sometimes not discussed at the top. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you what fascinated us about this entire project, and at the risk of repeating something we said earlier, what we found just astonishing when we were in, again, the foothills of the Sierras or places in Texas or the upper Middle West or little towns in Michigan, A lot of these people have a very good fix on some of the issues that are facing the country. And a lot of those people talk about these issues all the time. Strangely enough, contrary to what many of our perceptions are about people not caring about this and that, I think a lot of the country is very upset and very worried and very concerned about the direction it's moving. Whether or not that will bubble up to debates at the top or not, I don't know. And this may get back to some bankruptcy of political theory and thought and provocative ideas. But people down below, I think, have a good feel for what some of those issues are and they're concerned about.
That's absolutely right. It was just mind-boggling, the recognition of ordinary working people have of the problems that are out there. They could sit down and talk about it far better than anything you would hear out of Washington, or quite frankly, anything you hear out of the candidates.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of people in Philadelphia are talking about this series of articles, and a lot of people are really outraged by what you've revealed, by the inequities that you've revealed. I'm wondering what kind of impact you wanted this series to have. I don't know if you think of it in those terms when you're actually doing the research.
No, we don't. I think that's another reason we've worked together so long. We operate from the position that we lay the information out there for people. And if they respond to it, fine. And if they don't, okay. But we're not missionaries, and that's not the purpose of this kind of reporting. It's simply to collect information that people can't get from any other source and to give it to them and then let them react to it. And it does work. It worked in our last series, The Great Tax Giveaway, because that resulted in such an outpouring of mail to Congress that the Tax Writing Committee shut down the process of transition rules in which they gave tax breaks to certain individuals, targeted tax breaks to specific individuals. And the response was incredible, and so it works.
Well, thank you both very much.
Well, thank you.
Donald Bartlett and James Steele have just completed a series of investigative articles in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the series is called America, What Went Wrong? It's about the dismantling of the American middle class. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.